This podcast is an adaptation of the live radio broadcast of On Wisconsin, containing just the discussion segment. Next time, to catch the whole episode, tune in every Sunday at 3 p.m. on 91.7 FM Madison or streaming worldwide on WSUM.org. Thank you and enjoy.
We are back. You are listening to On Wisconsin on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. For those of you who are just tuning in, we are joined today by Representative Francesca Hong. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm also here joined today with two other reporters.
I'm Kayla Dembeck.
And I'm Ray Kirsch, the talk director here at WSUM.
And just before we get started, I would like to remind everyone that the opinions expressed on the show do not reflect the views of WSUM, UW-Madison, or its Board of Regents. So, Francesca Hong is a 76th Assembly District Representative, and you guys are currently in the 2023 to 2024 legislative session. You are also the first Asian American member of the Wisconsin Legislature when you were elected in 2020. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And what did that feel like?
It was a mix of pressure and pride. I think it's really important when we're talking about first for any position that the first responsibility is actually to make sure you're not the last. And so for me, it's really about mobilizing the Asian American community here in Wisconsin and ensuring that they know that serving in the legislature is possible.
Yeah, going along with that, just recently, Tony Evers signed a bill which requires Asian American and Hmong American history to be taught in Wisconsin schools. And as a fellow Madisonian, I personally did not grow up learning Asian American history in schools. So what was that like for you, seeing that moment?
It was historic, and I think I felt most proud of all of the organizing that has been going on for the last, I mean, it was first introduced in 2004, but the last 4 years we've seen a multi-generational and multi-ethnic movement of folks calling their legislator, having roundtables in their communities. And so for me, it really felt like this amazing collective win, this shared pride, and knowing that so much of the community was a part of both being a part of history and a part of future.
Yeah, definitely. And for people who maybe don't understand why this is important, what would you say to them?
So this actually amends Act 31, which was passed in the 1980s, where the statute reads that there must be instruction on Black Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics. And so the somewhat deliberate exclusion of Asian Americans, I think, is what really motivated for it to be first introduced in 2004. Wisconsin has the third largest Hmong population in the country, and it was really Hmong-led organizations, including veterans, nonprofits, and other mutual aid groups as well, and students and families who pushed for this bill. And then I think having an ally, additional ally in the legislature, because it was introduced previously, there were other state representatives who were really spearheading the bill, including Representative Katrina Shanklin from Stevens Point and Representative Pat Snyder, who's from Wausau, that I think we were able to really expand and let the communities know that this was going to be a bipartisan effort and a priority amongst legislators.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. As a native Madisonian, what is it now like for you to represent us in legislature?
I'm so incredibly proud. It's absolutely an honor. And I think because, you know, I'm homegrown and I haven't always been proud to identify as Korean American, and now not only feel that newfound pride of it, I'm so excited to really have my son have the opportunities to learn more about the diaspora of the Asian American community, our contributions throughout history, the way we've built solidarity with other communities of color, specifically in the civil rights era with the Black community, that this is a time for me to be hopeful and encouraged and feel very safe and secure about where our young people are going to take bills like this and ensure that we have a collective future that really is rooted in multiculturalism.
Yeah, we also discussed this a little bit during the break, but for listeners who maybe aren't familiar, what led you to run for the legislature?
I think first it was grief and chaos. With the pandemic, we were forced to close our restaurant. I mean, I would say we absolutely wanted to for public safety. But then I realized that the failure in leadership in the state legislature, and the state legislature has an immense amount of power in our state. They control the purse strings. They really do dictate how much local government can provide services to folks. And I was seeing this failure in leadership trickle down and impact communities like the service industry the hardest. As a restaurant owner at the time, we knew that we would be the first to close and the last to open. And our workers are some of the most vulnerable workers in community. So wanting to be not only a voice for the service industry and working families across the community, I really think I viewed the role of a state representative to be to uplift and provide a platform to these communities, because I've always believed that folks who are closest to the issues are most likely and most qualified to work towards solutions.
Yeah, and how do you continue maintaining contact with people who are closest to those issues now?
Well, it's very important that legislators meet communities where they are. And so whether it's visiting our public schools, making sure that I'm listening to the concerns of young people, and making sure that we keep our office, you know, with an open door, being responsive to all the folks who are looking for resources to be connected with other legislators, whether at the federal level or the local level, and making sure that I am attending events that are very community-oriented, whether that be neighborhood block parties or gatherings celebrating good work that's being done in the community. And for me personally, I have a vested interest in improving our food systems. And so whether it was legislation for healthy school meals for all, ensuring that all K-12 students would have access to free breakfast, lunch, and snack, to making sure that our small farmers and farm-to-school programs and people who are working to ensure that we not only have healthier food systems, but food sovereignty. Because I think the healthier a community is, it's really how they have more opportunities to not just be surviving and what many folks are experiencing by struggling with rising costs and whatnot. I think it's important to let community know that it doesn't have to be this way and that everyone really does deserve to thrive.
Yeah, kind of jumping off the idea of everyone thriving, I know that you authored a bill, the Family and Medical Leave Bill. How have you seen that one play out, and what do you hope to gain from that bill?
So it was, again, a collective effort in the legislature to introduce the most comprehensive and progressive paid family and medical leave legislation. And really, it should not be something that people should have to ask for to choose between their job and taking care of a loved one or taking care of themselves. And so I think establishing that right, that norm, that when we have paid leave, we're actually strengthening and making the workforce healthier. And I was so proud and encouraged when I saw that paid leave was passed here in the university. And again, this is something that when we have healthier communities, we have healthier opportunities. And that's, I think, a right that every single person should have.
Yeah, I have a question that's kind of similar to the one Hiwan asked about serving people in the Madison area, as you're somebody from Madison. So since the beginning of your time in legislature, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in the Madison area or in Wisconsin as a whole?
Youth leadership. When we had a critical spring election last year with the election of Justice Janet Protasiewicz, it was the student vote, it was the youth vote that really allowed us to secure that win. I am seeing the rise of students organizing, understanding right away that we can't get wins for our communities without building that multiracial and multi-ethnic, and really telling folks that regardless of your zip code or where you come from or who you love, you are deserving of this opportunity to thrive. And young people just inherently know that. And so it gives folks an opportunity to organize more. And I think seeing, you know, two students and folks who had just graduated now serving on city council to we've got one of our youngest legislators who's in leadership serving as the minority assistant leader for the Democratic caucus. He's, I think, 25 years old. And so when we have youth leadership, I think it consistently forces other legislators to think about more what's possible, have a broader vision. And when we center the needs and whether it's student loan debt to the housing crisis to insurance, ensuring that we have democratic communication, right? I think that TikTok bill was really, it's made folks really uncomfortable and discouraged. But I know that when we have youth leadership and seeing that grow, right? And that's where I really feel most hopeful. And if we don't have hope in this moment, we really can't build a better future.
Yeah, that's amazing. I feel like in Madison, youth leadership and seeing young people just take initiative is so impressive, because before coming here to school here, I just did not know the power that, you know, a group of students between the ages of 18 and 23 could have in impacting a community and impacting a school.
Yeah, speaking of initiative, you also talked a little bit about your experience in the food and the food service industry, but you helped found the Culinary Ladies Collective alongside your industry colleagues. Can you tell us a little bit about that collective?
Yeah, so that really came out of gathering a group of women right after the 2016 election out of both fear and motivation to fight for folks who are underrepresented. The majority of executive positions, chef positions, or restaurant ownership are male in our community. And so when we came together, we recognized that our talents could contribute to really supporting organizations that we cared about. So from, you know, essentially like big bake sale, we were able to raise almost $20,000 for Planned Parenthood. We planned and organized the first ever women and femme art and food festival here in the city at Garver Feed Mill. And so the Culinary Ladies Collective really did just come from a gathering of folks concerned over an issue and recognizing that, you know, collective power is how we were going to spark change. And regardless of what position you had in the service industry, I mean, we had baristas to line cooks to chefs and restaurant owners, that recognizing again our collective power was what kept the Culinary Ladies Collective going. And it really is now a forum that's important for folks especially femmes and women in the industry. And so people post in there when there's a job opportunity, ask questions about equipment or, you know, and we've got folks, you know, not just in Madison, but other parts of Dane County. So even though I'm disappointed that I'm not as involved anymore, I know that it really does live on as a community space.
Yeah, and how has your experience in the service industry translated now to your work in politics?
I think it allows me to center service, and I think that it allows me to value authenticity more. You know, I'm incredibly proud to be a part of the service industry community, and I think it's inherently always going to be a part of who I am. And folks in the service industry, we're built different. And, you know, they say that everyone should have a little bit of experience working in service because you recognize that people can absolutely come together regardless of political ideology, zip code, where they're from, over a good drink, over a good meal. And we really do need to fight this discomfort that comes from polarization in our community and our government right now. And one of the ways to do that is to gather around food and share conversation and see what, you know, unites us more than divides us. And so I think for me, service industry allows me to actually reach across the aisle and talk to my colleagues about, you know, what the struggles of being in the service industry and running a restaurant or a bar right now. And I think no matter what community you are in across Wisconsin, there are these really important third spaces like restaurants and bars that bring people together. And so it also allows me to center that in legislation that I care about.
Yeah, kind of switching gears. What are your favorite dishes to cook?
This is gonna sound funny, but I actually really like making instant ramen, even though my restaurant previously was a very like rooted in traditional ramen technique. But I like to take Korean ramen and add, you know, either kimchi or sometimes even peanut butter. And it sounds weird, but I think for me, it's comforting. And it's one of the foods that my son enjoys the most. And then I also have an affinity for soft scrambled eggs with a little bit of pecorino cheese and cracked black pepper. I think it's a really difficult dish to make well and right. But when you do, it's this like silky, wonderful experience, and you can have it with toast. You could have it in its own. And I think once in a while, you know, I want something that's easy and that I can be creative with. And I also like dishes that are very technically driven.
What are some of your favorite Korean ramens?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I like the OG Shin Ramyun, and I would also have noguri, but right now we probably have Jin ramen the most.
Classic. Yeah. I also feel like ramen is a very nostalgic food for me, especially like chapagetti. Like that. I know mm-hmm. that's technically not like ramen, but I feel like whenever I taste it, like that just brings me back to like my childhood. I feel like that's mac and cheese for me. Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, that's chapagetti, and now you can actually get like jjajang, which is a little bit closer to jjajangmyeon, but it's definitely another one that my son enjoys. And it's actually another one that you can kind of dress up with a fried egg or a little bit of gochugaru. And I think you're absolutely right. It's comfort food, and it was one of the first dishes that I could make on my own, and that's same with ramen. So that's the memory that it sparks for me, is that when my mom, she actually went back to school here at UW to get her degree in music education and general music. And so when my sister and I were home waiting for her, those were the dishes we made.
Sorry, go ahead. This might be kind of a deeper, more like loaded question, I guess, but you mentioned your son and how the education bill that was passed, how you really hope that that benefits him and his generation. And in general, like as a whole, what type of future are you and the rest of the legislation trying to build for younger generations?
That's a fantastic question. And I think that's, we're trying to build one that's rooted in security, but also one that no one should feel like they can't reach their potential. And I think we don't live in a society anymore that values curiosity and vulnerability. And I think when students feel secure to be able to be their most authentic self in the classroom, and I think that learning about different histories and being able to better understand one another with learning those histories, it will help build a future where young people can, again, see opportunities, know that they have this potential, and always be driven, you know, by curiosity and vulnerability as a way to empower themselves. And that gets lost in adulthood, but I really do trust your generation and then George's generation to really build and be driven by vision as well, like a vision for better. We're in pretty, like, a lot of people are grieving right now, and there's a lot of despair, and especially with mental health challenges. But I think that more, if we see vulnerability as power, and I think young people have a better understanding of that, they're going to be able to build, again, a future where your potential is not challenged. And, you know, we understand collective strength as well.
Yeah, going off of that, what are some of the biggest challenges you see in the legislature right now?
There are days where I'm like, we're absolutely just sliding into authoritarianism, right? There are bills that directly challenge and roll back voting rights. We've seen ballot boxes, accessibility to voting, especially for our disability community. Republicans undermining that. There are intentional, I don't know if folks remember, there were two ballot initiatives in this last spring election, and they were intentionally worded, people were pretty confused. And they are now, it's like we shouldn't be passing constitutional amendments or changes in the Constitution without a legislative process and having people who are experts in elections, especially when we don't fund them, right? So our agencies, our communities, especially our local governments, are always asked to do more with less. And when we undermine our local governments, that means services for our communities, whether it's emergency services or funding our public parks and our libraries. Those are taking away opportunities for folks, especially folks who might be in underrepresented communities. So my biggest challenge and fear in the legislature is that, you know, I see my colleagues using this agenda of divide, distract, and destroy. And they don't want us to see that we have more shared values across different generations and across different zip codes across our state, right? A lot of people are concerned about their public schools. Many people are concerned about the fact that there are towns that can't pay their firefighters, and so many people are volunteers. And it makes folks live in more of a state of fear and uncertainty, which makes it harder to come together as a community. And so legislation like, increasing minimum wage, having paid leave, expanding childcare, eliminating student loan debt, those are things that every community does care about. And when we actually have legislation that are those initiatives and actually have government, be a force of good, we're able to really combat this agenda to divide us.
Yeah, has serving in the legislature made you more optimistic, pessimistic, both, neither?
I will always be nauseously optimistic about our state. I think, again, having a change in the balance of the state Supreme Court, having a Democratic governor that is committed to vetoing harmful bills, especially ones that target, you know, the trans community or is harmful to our environment, and especially in addressing things like PFAS and CAFOs. I know that the legislature won't be the makeup that it is for much longer, that we have fairer maps and there's going to be better, more fair representation for every community. And that makes me hopeful. And again, it's youth leadership and seeing the empowerment, seeing youth feeling empowered and wanting to get more involved and staying engaged in politics. I mean, I think many of you know that if you don't do politics, politics does you. And it's important to really make sure voices are heard and collective voices are heard, right?
Yeah, so as we move into a big election year, I would say, what message do you have for youth voters, especially in Wisconsin?
Even through despair and through grief and feeling hopeless, we are powerful when we come together. And I would encourage all youth voters to remember that this is an election that will make or break your future. And we can't, I think right now there's a sense that we can talk about voting or try to encourage people to vote through shame, right? When there's a lot of folks that I think feel very indifferent and disillusioned about the state of American politics. But it is young people who are going to be the biggest force of change, which means you are also the most, like, you are our sign of hope.
What are some ways that you've been instilling the value of youth empowerment, particularly in your son, George?
I tell him and I tell everyone this because a very wise woman once told me, nobody needs permission to lead. And so I see him sometimes leading in his classrooms, which is, for me, helping people. And I think when you understand that leadership matters most when you're fostering leadership around you, I hope that meeting young people where they're at, regardless of what age they may be, they feel as though they deserve to be a leader, they deserve to reach their potential. And, you know, leadership really has to be collective. And for me, it's about servant leadership and understanding that through service and in service, it's how we're going to empower one another and feel taken care of.
Yeah, and I think we have time for just one more question. So is there anything else that you'd like to share before we end for today?
I think I just want to let folks know that if we don't take care of one another, we won't survive. And ultimately, so much of community building and building a sustainable community relies on us just recognizing our shared humanity, and reaching out to a neighbor can really still make a difference right now.
Representative Hong, thank you so much for joining us in studio today.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure to talk with you all.
Thank you for listening to On Wisconsin News, reported by Badgers for the rest of Wisconsin. I'm Hee-Won Lim.
I'm Kayla Dembeck.
And I'm Ray Kirsch. Thanks again, and tune in next week.